This was the desperate farewell of Madame Chiang Kai-shek.
My husband, Chiang Kai-shek, of all the world's statesmen, was the first to perceive the treachery of the communists.
The National Broadcasting Company's News and Special Events Department brings you Voices and Events, the living record of history this week. You'll hear Madame Chiang Kai-shek, Secretary of State Atchison, Senator Taft, Hanses Branson, Winston Churchill, and Clement Attlee. These and many others. You'll hear the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now, here's your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
Today, on the banks of the River Thames at Chatham, England, even hope has run out. From the British Admiralty, a statement that no hope can be entertained for any further survivors of the submarine Truculent. 65 men of the submarine's crew perished. 15 lived. This man was one of them.
And I went up, opened the hatch, and as soon as I opened the hatch, I was sort of torn up through the water by this satch, you see.
How long did it take you to get to the surface, do you think?
Well, I have no idea, really. I mean, it was just sort of a case of going up through water.
Yeah. Did it seem a long time?
Well, I couldn't say, really.
Now, tell me, from your point of view, would you think there's anybody left down there alive now?
Well, that's a job to say. I mean, I was the first one out.
Yes, I see.
I mean, the man who's the last one out.
Yes.
Would be the one to say that.
Well, the man who was last out is not here, but here's the man who was next to last out. And your name is?
Buckingham.
And your rank?
Electrical artificer. I said to the chief ERA, are you going up now or shall I? He told me to carry on. So I went up and swam around the surface, waited for him to come up, and then we swam away together, but I lost him because the tide took him away.
Yes, I see. Now, do you know what happened to the man who was last out?
No idea. He just left me, that's all.
From Washington comes word of a new crisis over China. The State Department announces China's communists have seized the American consulate at Beijing.
The week just ending was one of serious concern for American diplomats in the Far East. And now, news that communists have seized our consulate at Beijing. The State Department says an action without precedent. Because of it, all American officials today were ordered by Washington to leave China. Another burden for our policymakers pressed from many sides. And within the last 24 hours, Madame Chiang Kai-shek has joined her husband in lonely refuge on the island of Formosa. This was the message she left behind in America.
I speak to you today to say goodbye, to thank you for your kind hospitality, and to hope that perhaps my next visit to the United States will be in a happier atmosphere, when my country will again be free from the ponderous hoofs of an alien invader. For more than 20 years, my husband has led his people in the fight against communism. Chiang Kai-shek, of all the world's statesmen, was the first to perceive the treachery of the communists. He was the first to fight them. Now he is pilloried. Times have changed, but the man has not changed. My husband remains resolute to lead his people against the alien invaders and their alien ideas.
In the voice of Madame Chiang Kai-shek, we heard the tragedy of China. The fight was over. A ruined nation was left to its destiny. Britain had switched its recognition to the communist government. And while others of the West, including the USA, weren't as yet ready for that move, the pressure was on. Twice this week, in the United Nations Security Council, Russia's representative stalked angrily from the room to protest the presence of the delegate from Nationalist China, the voice of Jacob Malik and the translator.
Совет безопасности, рассмотрев заявление Центрального народного правительства Китайской Народной Республики от 8 января,
further wish to state that if the Security Council does not take suitable measures for the removal from the Security Council of the representative of the Kuomintang group, the Soviet delegation will not participate in the Security Council until the representative of the Kuomintang group is removed from membership in the Security Council.
And our State Department found itself the center of a stormy controversy. From many sides came the accusations. It seemed at times no one was satisfied with American policy on China. For a while, the center of attention was the Esbranson steamship line's vessel, the Flying Arrow, attacked by nationalist gunboats as it tried to bring cargo to the port of Shanghai, now in communist hands.
I am Hans Isbjörnsson of Isbjörnsson Company. There's been so much loose talk to the effect that vessels of our line engaged in regular world-round service are blockade runners. Our vessels are not now and never have carried contraband or combat material to China. In the words of the State Department itself, nobody questions that the attack upon the Flying Arrow took place in international waters or outside the area over which China can claim jurisdiction. On the basis of the master's reports as to his distress and other circumstances, the Flying Arrow is now proceeding to Tsingtao as a near safe port. We are not, however, abandoning or interrupting our regular services to Hong Kong, Shanghai, and other Chinese ports, which we have maintained for years and intend to maintain.
As we talked this week with Isbjörnsson, we found him a determined man, a firm, let's say, devout believer in free enterprise, convinced that foreign trade is and should be a vigorous and vital resource of the USA. He saw no moral wrong in trading with communist China. He said, "We trade with Russia and East Europe, don't we?" His views were strong, too, when we recall that the State Department had taken a backhanded slap at his company for ignoring the nationalist blockade, while the department itself refused to recognize it. Hans Isbjörnsson thought he knew what was wrong.
Well, the State Department, to my way of thinking, is a rather cumbersome institution. The department takes too long to get into action. Trouble is nearly all over when they get into it. It's too slow. I say that without disrespect to the department or its secretary.
The dispute between the State Department and the Isbjörnsson Company was fought out in the newspapers. We asked if anyone in the department had called on Isbjörnsson or discussed his difficulties with him.
In my long history, I have never received a call from the State Department for any consultation.
So we asked Hans Isbjörnsson, would he welcome such an opportunity?
I'm not a supplicant to anybody.
For different reasons, there were others who thought the Department of State a cumbersome thing, dedicated to a too little, too late policy in the Orient. Left-wingers at work, said Ohio Senator Robert Taft, who had his own views on what should be done for China and Formosa.
Formosa is 100 miles from the mainland, and there can be no crossing if our Navy makes it clear that ships carrying troops will not be allowed to cross. The basis of our foreign policy in the last 3 or 4 years, except in China, has been to contain communism where it is and prevent any single step of advance. Because, as at Munich, success in any such step is certain to lead to another step. There is not the slightest evidence that Russia will go to war with us because we interfere with a crossing to Formosa.
On the floor of the Senate, Taft hammered home his argument that if we gave more and sincere aid to Chiang Kai-shek, the communists could at least be contained. Next day, to defend the administration's policy, Secretary of State Dean Acheson spoke to the National Press Club in Washington.
I have been in this business of foreign relations too long to believe that anyone can be sure about results. In fact, I don't believe that anybody's judgments are infallible. And so when I read, as I read in the press this morning, the words of a distinguished statesman who said that there was no doubt that if there had been sincere aid given to the government of China some years ago, that there would have been no difficulty. And the broad picture is that after the war, Chiang Kai-shek emerged as the undisputed leader of the Chinese people. Only one faction, the communists, up in the hills, ill-equipped, ragged, a very small military force were determinedly opposed to his position. He had overwhelming military power, greater military power than any ruler had ever had in the entire history of China. Now, 4 years later, what do we find? 4 years later, we find that his armies have melted away, his support in the country has melted away, his support largely outside the country has melted away. And he is a refugee on a small island off the coast of China with the remnant of his forces. What happened, in my judgment, is that the almost inexhaustible patience of the Chinese people in their misery ended. And they swept, they didn't bother to overthrow this government. There was really nothing to overthrow. They simply ignored it. The communists didn't create this condition. They didn't create this revolutionary spirit. They didn't create the great force which moved out from under Chiang Kai-shek. But they were shrewd and cunning enough to mount it, to ride this thing into victory and into power.
Careful notice, too, by the Secretary, that Soviet Russia is annexing and absorbing China's northern provinces. Present American policy, then, based on a hope that Chinese communism will eventually clash with Russian imperialism.
Evidence this week that vaudeville may have died because so many people run for Congress.
A sideshow in Washington this week as the Capitol's officialdom turned out to audition for what may be the biggest amateur hour ever staged. It's all for the benefit of the American Heart Association, and the talent came from many high places. Vice President and Mrs. Barkley promised to join the cast, but their act is still a secret. Bird whistles by Mrs. Claude Pepper, the wife of the Florida senator, and the Navy was represented, too. Take Admiral DeWitt Clinton Ramsey, a top Navy airman, and Captain John Waters and Captain Slim Beachers, two pianos and a guitar, and a song of their own composition.
With all of its thrills, whether you're mama or papa, whether your hair is straight or curled, there's no place like Macalapa. It's the happiest spot in the world.
Indeed, there's no place like Macalapa, nor any more lively talent than among the top Navy brass. If official Washington seemed a bit lowbrow this week, there was also some trouble with high hats. NBC's Earl Godwin got the story.
The headache at the White House has been headroom in the official automobiles for visiting high hat dignitaries. White House official chariots have been five-seater automobiles, comfortable enough and fine enough as to equipment, but too low in the ceiling. Official high hats have scraped the tops, and that's a terrific fault in a ceremony with people who still awe the common mass of taxpayers with those gleaming silk toppers. And so Charlie Ross, the President's Secretary, told reporters today that 8 new 7-passenger cars have been ordered for official use with measurements allowing high hats and plenty of headroom. That matter doesn't worry President Truman, however. He likes the open air and open cars even for state occasions. But the silk toppers of many another dignitary have had to be lifted off the very important person's domes and carried in the laps. But now no more. A silk hat on the head is worth 12 in the lap. And that's all from Godwin at this time.
As usual, money was a big topic in Washington this week, with the administration sending Congress its requests for appropriations and the Republicans fighting hard for every penny. There's one man in Congress whose cry of, "Where's the money coming from?" has been heard these many years. Hopefully, Representative Rich of Pennsylvania is changing his slogan now.
Ever since 1936, I have been asking the Congress the great question, where are you going to get the money? Last year, I changed that slogan to be wise and economize. And that did not seem to get the members of Congress to reduce their spending. So I've changed it this year, be nifty and thrifty in 50. And I hope we will get some results.
Oh, perhaps we will. But when President Truman asked for $42 billion in his budget this week, $5 billion more than the government expects to take in, we set out to sample congressional opinion. Here's New York's newly elected Senator Herbert Lehman.
Obviously, the main programs in the budget, including defense, debt service, foreign aid, and the care of veterans, defy any substantial reduction. It's equally obvious, however, that wherever the Congress can cut appropriations without crippling essential services or essential programs, they must be cut. On the other hand, we cannot either tie the President's hand by refusing to provide for the programs he requests or tie down the executive branch of the government with instructions to carry out a program, but without giving him funds to do so. An unbalanced budget is inevitable this year to avoid an unbalanced nation.
NBC Washington put the question to the senator from Vermont.
What do you think about the president's budget, Senator Aiken?
Well, although the president's budget was larger than the Congress had hoped for, yet I don't think that anyone is really surprised. But if we want to be practical, we'll realize that this is an election year and it's going to be unusually difficult to reduce appropriations for particular purposes. I don't look for any great overall reduction in the appropriations bill this year. And by the same reasoning, I don't look for any overall increase in taxes and possibly a reduction in taxes in some lines, particularly in the field of excise taxes.
And reflecting what seems to be the dominant Republican view is Pennsylvania's Senator Martin.
Senator Martin, how does the president's budget message strike you?
It seems to me the president's budget is entirely too high. There should be several drastic cuts. It seems to me that we can cut down some of our aid, European aid. We can cut down on national defense. And I'm awfully sorry that there isn't any provision in the president's budget for a payment on the national debt. Definite deficit financing can absolutely destroy America.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now from the NBC newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
Folks in the big town got quite a surprise this week. Mayor O'Dwyer came out for legal gambling. No doubt about it, plenty of gambling goes on in New York City. Periodic crackdowns on the bookies don't seem to stop it, and what can you do about the bettors? With parimutuel betting already legalized at New York racetracks, Mayor O'Dwyer wanted to go a step further. The reporter, Leon Pearson.
Mayor William O'Dwyer surprised the town by saying that after observing gambling in New York for 40 years, he'd come to the conclusion it should be legalized. I doubt if gambling could be stamped out, he said, if every policeman in New York were assigned to the job.
With the mayor's proposal in mind, Voices and Events turn to the state where gambling is not only legal, but a thriving industry. Station KOH in Reno asked a Chamber of Commerce spokesman to talk about Nevada's wide-open and quite lawful games of chance.
Sir, you are familiar with the statement made today by Mayor O'Dwyer?
Yes, I think that most Renoites have shown a great deal of interest in the comments of Mayor O'Dwyer. The problem which he poses is a problem which the state of Nevada faced many years ago, and which we decided in favor of legalized gaming under strict state control.
Well, how is it controlled here in Nevada?
All operators must secure a state gaming license from the State Gaming Tax Commission, as well as pass the rigid requirements of the various municipalities. Our tax commission is composed of a representative of agriculture, banking, stock raising, mining, and a general business representative, in addition to the governor and the public service commissioner. Nevadans feel that such representation ensures proper control.
Well, thank you. This is Larry Garrity in Reno.
But what thought New Yorkers of this idea? The sporting fraternity was gathered outside Madison Square Garden talking to Voices and Events reporter Chet Hagen.
I think it's a good idea. I think it'll take it out of the hands of the guys who hang around saloons and in front of bars and kids who hang out in front of schools and take nickel bets. In my own neighborhood, there's a cluster of them every morning. When the track opens, they beat it like the devil was after them.
What about betting on other sports events?
Well, I think people ought to get a fair shake for their money, and if it was in the hands of people who did it legally, they'd get a fair return on their bet.
And let it be said, there were those who saw legal gambling as a noble way to increase the state's revenues.
I agree along the same lines as Mayor O'Dwyer.
Well, the way conditions are in New York, there'll always be gambling unless it's legalized, which would make things much better for the public.
You'll cut out the graft and you can cut out everything else like that.
I think legal betting would give taxes which the government, both state, city, and federal, would have a hand in, and that could be used for schooling and stuff like that.
It's a pity that the revenue that comes out of these gambling efforts don't go to good causes.
Still others say lawful betting is one way to make sporting events more honest. We asked this fellow, how about it? How often do you suppose the fix is on?
Well, hard to say. I don't think the games are fixed. I still think sport is on the up and up. And I don't think the bookies have affected the outcome of the games in any way. There's a lot of vicious rumors going around. The team loses a game. Right away, everybody says the game was dumped. Now, let's bring everything out in the open, and if the game is dumped, I want to know who did it and why and who are the people responsible for it.
But then again, where the Broadway crowd was all for it, there were those in responsible positions in society who thought differently.
I am Dr. Samuel McRae Cavert, General Secretary of the Federal Council of the Churches of Christ in America. By encouraging the idea of getting something for nothing, of securing financial return without rendering any service, gambling tends to undermine basic ideals of honesty and public welfare. I cannot believe that the great empire state is reduced to the level of securing public revenue at the expense of social morality.
At week's end, the politically wise were saying that Mayor O'Dwyer's proposal for legal gambling had no chance at all. And the bookies? Well, they were giving odds against it, too.
For the people of Great Britain this week, news that they would soon have a chance to decide the future of their government. Coming up next month, elections for all of England.
It's 5 years now since Britain's voters chose the path of socialism. 5 hard years of austerity with the Labour Party in control. As England votes in 1950, it's again a time of crisis, of uncertainty at what lies ahead. It was that way, too, in 1945 in July, with the war in Japan still unfinished. A coalition government was in power in London, but its head was Winston Churchill, and its direction was conservative. Churchill made a strong bid for power. The experts thought this giant of a statesman was a sure bet to win. July 26th, 1945, the day they counted the votes. This was Ed Hocker reporting from London.
History was made in England today, and the implications are far-reaching. By early afternoon, it was apparent Mr. Churchill's government was being snowed under. At 7 o'clock, Mr. Churchill drove to Buckingham Palace and handed the king his resignation. At 7:30, Clement Attlee arrived at the palace and accepted the king's invitation to form a new cabinet.
Sudden and unexpected was this news that the left wing had triumphed. Reaction was immediate. Again, the 1945 broadcast from NBC London.
In Britain, only recently have working people come to take for granted what we've accepted for years. Good working conditions, for example, and a 2-week vacation each year. But the voters think improvements can still be made, and today's election result was a mighty protest. The crumbs of feudalism may be disappearing. This is Ed Hawker in London, returning you to NBC in New York.
That same night, as Britain embarked on a new era, commentator H.V. Kautenborn.
The London Daily Telegraph asked me today to comment on Churchill's defeat. Here is what I said. My one personal regret is that the result should seem to come as a personal rebuke to one of the great men of all time, to whom so many owe so much. I hope the British Labour Party will now be able to give the British people a larger measure of that good life which they have so richly deserved.
Now, 5 years later, and the campaign has already begun. 1949 was perhaps the most trying year for the Labour government, with England on the brink of economic disaster. Let's go back to April of last year, when financial chief Sir Stafford Cripps announced the government's new budget, which gave promise of nothing but more hardship ahead.
It's very easy, and of course most attractive, to urge reductions in taxation. It's a simple way of courting popularity, and I should be abandoning my trust and shirking my responsibility if I were to advise you that we could afford to lower taxation generally at this critical stage of our recovery.
Sometimes the pressure was eased, a bit more food available, and then this welcome moment when Harold Wilson of the Board of Trade announced to the nation,
I have today signed an order ending completely the clothes rationing system. From tomorrow morning, coupons will no longer be required for the purchase of any kind of clothing or textile.
Again, there was American aid, the Marshall Plan, which played a major role in keeping Britain's head above the water. But the Marshall Plan was not the answer to all problems. ECA Administrator Paul Hoffman was critical of British industry.
British manufacturers have not yet begun to tap the huge reservoir of American buying power. That is a challenge confronting the business statesmanship of Britain.
The root of Britain's troubles in the year just passed came to be known as the dollar gap. Exports weren't bringing in enough of the badly needed American currency. The dollar reserve was running short. Conservatives hounded the labor rights, charged that socialist experiments were too costly for a nation in such precarious financial position. Inevitable, it seemed, was the devaluation of the pound sterling. With that drastic action taken, Prime Minister Attlee spoke to his worried countrymen.
I have told you that the position is critical. We have a great opportunity to set things right. Let us seize it. In their sphere, the government have taken vigorous action. I ask you all, men and women, to play your part and help to bring the country through.
By law, the government of Britain must call general elections every 5 years or sooner. As the deadline neared, Labour Party leaders showed grave concern. Many were the voices raised in protest against them. There was no doubt, for example, that this housewife had had enough of socialism.
Food is rising, houses are not available, dearer when you get them, and I'm very worried about the unemployment situation, which is bound to come at the end of this rake's progress. Stands to sense. You can't spend all you have in the bank and then go on expecting people to give you more. And I don't like being dependent for one-third of what I eat on charity.
If there are enough of like view, Britain will veer to the right on February 23rd. Capitalism will make a comeback. Yet, in spite of the rigors of daily life in Britain, the Labour government held fast to its power in the 5 years now ending. Again and again, in parliamentary by-elections, Labour candidates won. And as 1949 drew to a close, a drab and dreary year for Britons, Labour did it again. A by-election in the district of Bradford South, and the townspeople gathered in the square to hear the results from a loudspeaker.
Mr. John Lightfoot Wendell received 19,000. Received 19,313. Mr. George Cluddock has therefore been given a majority of 4,024.
That was Labour's most recent victory. A straw in the wind, perhaps. An indication that the democratic people of England will see it through in this their great experiment with socialism. But outstanding in the weeks of campaigning to come will be a man of such stature as few before him in British politics. It may well be said that the hopes of conservatism lie in Winston Churchill.
Do not, my friends, I beg you, underrate the enduring strength of Britain. Do not suppose that half a century from now you will not see 70 or 80 millions of Britain spread about the world and united in defense of our traditions, our way of life, and the world causes which you and we espouse.
Will Winston Churchill and his conservatives again rule Britain? The answer comes in just 5 weeks.
This has been Voices and Events, the living record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You've heard the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor has been James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking and inviting you to listen next week at this same time for Voices and Events.
What's on NBC tonight? Hollywood beauty Joan Fontaine introduces new talent on Hollywood Star Theater. Each Saturday, some promising actor or actress finds his dream come true when a famous star presents him on the Hollywood Star Theater. And stay tuned for a half hour of laughs and mayhem on Truth or Consequences with Ralph Edwards. Tonight on NBC, it's Hollywood Star Theater or Truth or Consequences.